Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast, in which we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it is playing a key role in reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. My name is Andrew Murray-Watson. My guest today is one of the best-known financiers in India and was an early pioneer of the Asian impact investment industry. Yet he has no formal financial training, and at the time he started his business in 2001, he knew more about forestry and fending off cobras than finance. Today, his Avishka Group comprises Avishka Capital, an impact investment fund manager, Arohan, a microfinance provider, IntelliGrow, a venture debt company, and Tribe3, a technology-enabled lending platform. The group manages assets in excess of $1.2 billion, operates in over 50 countries, and has over 7,000 employees. It meets the needs of entrepreneurs with investments ranging from as little as $150 to equity stakes of $15 million. So I'm delighted to have with me the founder of Avishka Group, Vinet Rai. Vinet, welcome to the Impact Equals podcast. It is a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
So let me start by asking you about how you got started, because it's one of those sort of sliding doors type moments. You might now have a career in the Indian Army, is that correct?
I was born on the border town called Jodhpur in Rajasthan. So I used to see a lot of army movement, and so as a young kid, you get inspired. At least they look very handsome when they drive in their jongas with a black bandana. So I was quite inspired. For some reason, army didn't like me, so they kept rejecting me. And army has this very positive way of rejecting you. They tell you that you're too good for us. And while it is done just to keep your morale high, there are some fools like me who genuinely believed that I was too good. So I did not give up. I just continued. And then I went into forestry, which was simply because it seemed like another exciting area. Not as exciting as army, but still exciting enough. Bear, elephants, and lion are not bad company. Spent 2-3 years in the forest, but my wife, I got married, and I did tell my wife that I'm living in a forest, I have a large house. Some important aspects that there is nobody who lives nearby, that the nearest rail station is 120 kilometers away. I promptly kept it to myself, including that electricity sometimes comes, sometimes doesn't come. Phone mostly doesn't work. When she landed up there, within a week or two, she realized this is not as fancy as I made it out to be. And so she gave me an ultimatum, said, you find a place out of this place or lose the life. And so basically the inspiration was to stay married. That I found myself out of the forest and landed up in IIM Ahmedabad, which is actually one of the best institutes, management institutes in India, very far away from where I was. I was in East India and then landed up in West India. And very different thought process. Everybody wanted to be richer, better, smarter. And I was transitioning out of a forest where I was meeting people who were coming from very poor background. And these poor people, and just because I was curious, I used to ask them, so what do you want to be? And almost everybody wanted to be better off. They all wanted to be in better place, wanted to earn more money, wanted to have a better life. And that pushed me in trying to understand, and just so that you understand, Indians are reasonably socialist when we are brought up. We are always told that rich people are not good and the poor people have a large heart. And here I was talking to poor people and everybody wanted to be rich. So I have never seen a rich guy trying to be poor. From there, I actually joined or was asked to set up an incubator, which was probably the first incubator in India. But an incubator for farmers. Farmers had dime a dozen ideas. They wanted to convert those ideas into enterprises. And that's where it occurred to me that, poor people, businesses don't engage with poor people. For many reasons, including something at work that I much later came to figure out called wallet share. A poor has such a small wallet that there is nothing much to share there. And when you actually make an investment, you generally look at your addressable market and see what is the money they can have, what is the disposable income they have. Now, so why would somebody build a business that engages with the poor? Because there is no disposable income there. And so what was very interesting to me was, if you actually start a venture or a business, you become rich. Poor people and rich people, one of the key differences was there was actually a fairly large number of rich people who have the resources, capability, and access to start a business or start an enterprise or venture out on their own, while the poor person has been venturing out on their own in a very broken ecosystem with no ability and capability to have this. So my takeaway was that poor want to be rich but don't have access. They don't have access to capability, skill, capital. And if somebody actually provides them that, there is a chance a lot of them probably can find their own way out of poverty. And when they come out of poverty, they might take a lot of other people out of poverty as well. Now, this is 2001. So you're talking about a period where there were only two worlds. One world used to say, we serve the poor. That's the not-for-profit philanthropic world. And then there was a world that said, we only serve the rich. That's actually the... There was no world that actually straddled both the sides. And I thought it might be a great idea if I can actually take rich people's money and help poor start the business so that they can become rich. And that's how I actually walked into what later on, 8 years later, became impact investing.
So you're armed with this, I guess, pretty unique perspective and insight. Tell me about sort of the very early days, because you're obviously doing something that in 2001 hasn't really been done before. There's no model, there's no pathway to follow in this for this. Just sort of unpack, if you like, those early days. What was the people's reaction when you came to them with this very different model, this very different idea of how to, as you said, investing in the underserved poorer demographics in India?
So in 2001, I quit my job. I had a very large sum of capital personally, $100. And I thought with this money and with all my confidence, I can raise a fund. Remember, I was a forester. I had no idea what finance meant. I had no idea how funds operated. But I was very convinced that poor people need to be given capital that can take risk, and they should be allowed to actually express, unleash their entrepreneurial energy to start it. And given that I was so convinced about it, it never dawned to me that I was the wrong guy to do it. I was not skilled. I didn't have the right networks. I just did not know that this is impossible, next to impossible. Because 2001 India, raising a venture capital fund, if you are a mainstream fund manager, was also impossible. For a person like me with no background, with $100 in his pocket, to actually do something that has never been done before was very stupid. And because I was ignorant, I had no shame. I was not shy in going up to anyone and asking them and telling them or sharing them the idea. The only thing I did not know is how to ask for money, which is a skill you must have. Otherwise, how will you become a fund manager? To my surprise, though, and this is where, Andrew, probably life changed for me, is I was also very pure probably at that time. I used to speak from the heart, not from the mind. And somehow people understand when your intent is very noble. Your skills and capability probably do not match up to what you're saying. But human instinct is to trust people. So when I actually started going and very passionately talking that, hey guys, there are poor people, they want to be rich, they want to start their own business, they don't have access to capital. And by the way, I want to actually do this. And they will ask me, nobody ever asked me, do you understand finance? Have you done fund management? They used to ask me, so how much do you know about poor? And I said, oh, I spend time in forest and I understand their aspirations and need. Invariably, people were willing to trust my instinct of knowing the core set of people that I was supposed to work with, rather than my ability to manage funds. But the moment I started receiving the capital, I started realizing that I can raise money once by actually being very naive and very open. But sooner or later, there will be accountability. You took my money, how will you return it? You took my money, did you misuse it? You took my money, did you do anything? Those kind of questions started appearing in my mind. And that forced me to start engaging with people who had more experience than me. I went to people who have managed funds and started asking them, so how do I actually do it the right way? I knew what I was doing. I knew the constituency I was going to deal with, but I did not know how to manage a fund. I did not know how to talk to a regulator. I did not know how to actually report back to investors. And those are the things that I learned by actually engaging with a large number of people, some of them my investors, who were willing to spend that extra time to do it. Again, the moment you have actually a noble thought and you're transparent and honest and you can keep your ego in check, enormous number of people in the world are willing to offer their goodwill, their advice, and their time and commitment. And a large number is willing to offer you money as well.
Thank you. And presumably your wife, who's motivated you just to get out of the forest and get a better remunerated job, at this point, does she think you've lost the plot entirely, or is she backing you? Or what's the mood like in the household?
Started in 2001, 2003, October 2003, December, my daughter was to be born. And I was deeply into the fund and everything. I had actually convinced my wife, she had 100,000 rupees. Which is roughly $2,000 at that point of time. So I had borrowed it from her, started a company called Intellectual Capital, because I genuinely believe that you don't need to just give money to the people. You need to take talent to rural India also, because only talent will help these ideas to blossom. So I had great ideas, but I did not know how to attract talent. So I created this company called Intellectual Capital, which was supposed to support the venture capital and build an ecosystem. And to set up that company, I needed this $2,000. That's the minimum requirement to set up a company. So I borrowed it from my wife and had set it up. Pretty much eaten away all the money in trying to set up a website. So there was no money left, all the money that I took her. But I gave her 50% of the company as part of the deal. By 2003, I was reasonably bankrupt because I was not earning anything. My little saving was all gone. I was getting some small things here, there by consulting. And one of my mentors, a gentleman called Vijay Mahajan, a very big name in India's social entrepreneurship sector, a brilliant guy. He was coming to my house and my wife said, this guy has gone mad and he's doing all kinds of things, not earning money. We don't know how to pay house rent. And Vijay Mahajan heard her and told me that for any social entrepreneur, the first responsibility is to yourself. So if you do not know how to survive, how will you help the world to change? I mean, your existence is as important as your ideas. So then he made a very big statement, which made a significant difference to my life. He was in microfinance, and microfinance in India at that point of time was very small. Insignificant, actually, by the size of India. And he said, Vineet, microfinance is going to be a very large space. This is all 2003, so microfinance was really small. And that you can, because you are trying to raise this fund, you understand poor, you understand a little bit about microfinance, you can actually be an arbitrator or an educator of the microfinance guys who largely come from philanthropic background. Introduce them the meaning of equity. What is equity? How do you raise it? What is leverage? What are the challenges? And at the same time, you can become our representative to those guys who may have interest to invest large amounts of money in microfinance down the line. And you can do so while doing all the work that you are doing for raising funds and impact. And at that time, the term impact investing was not there. So he said, whatever your social entrepreneurship movement that you are doing, continue with that. But why not help us? And we are also social entrepreneurs. So that's the two statements he made. That forced me to think that, okay, these guys are using money, even though they are lending, but they are using money to work with very poor people. These poor women are actually progressing in their lives. So not very different from what I want to do, even though I wanted to do it with entrepreneurs. So how about I treat them as also entrepreneurs who are changing lives and treat them as people whom I can actually provide capital. And since I don't have capital right now, why can't I, whatever little I have learned about equity, educate them? And so that change actually started getting me some capital because people started paying me for my advice. And that also became my experience and allowed me to raise a large fund. Not very large fund, but an $18 million fund So between 2001 and 2005, while I was advising on one side to microfinance tuition, I raised $1 million, which I invested in a lot of small enterprises doing artisanal work in rural India. And by 2007, I had jumped from $100 in 2001 to $1 million in 2005 to around $14 million. Two different funds, one focused on microfinance and one focused on other social entrepreneurs. And around 2007, also, we came up with the term impact investing to define what we were doing.
It's a fascinating story. As you mentioned before, I mean, when you started doing this, impact investing, the phrase had not been coined. What was your sort of primary motivation for doing what you're doing in terms of serving rural communities, serving the disadvantaged? Did you see yourself primarily as a social entrepreneur, or did you just see yourself as an investor that happened to be serving an underserved community?
So, Andrew, I think the more interesting question at that point of time was, I was neither an investor nor an entrepreneur, not a social entrepreneur. I was actually a seeker. So see me as a seeker who was looking for a solution to a problem. And the problem was that I met a lot of poor people who wanted to be rich. And I realized that they need to start or be part of a venture or a business. And that I realized the missing part was not the ideas, the missing part was capital. I saw a problem that a lot of people want to be entrepreneurs. There's no capital. There's no capital who's willing to take risk. And so I was actually trying to run around, collect that capital, bring it to the people who would then actually unleash their entrepreneurial creativity to change their own destiny. And that is what was my driver. I realized that whenever I went to people and asked them that, can you give me your money, especially when I started dealing with institutional capital, I realized that people wanted to bucket me under a certain label. And that label could be, are you a venture capital fund? Are you a private equity guy? Are you a lending? Are you a credit provider? And it seemed that whatever I was doing did not fit into any of the buckets. It didn't fit into venture capital because I was not doing pure technology. I was surely not doing private equity because I was pretty much the first check to all these entrepreneurs. I was really not doing lending because I was taking all the downside risks. So I wanted all the upside risk. And therefore, I did not meet any of the criteria. And so people found me interesting, but not worthy enough to give me the capital. And that was a trigger that said, hey, without a label, without a statement, an institution will never give you money. And that's when we started searching for an identity.
So just paint the picture for us, okay? Who's in the room at this stage? What is the setting where you actually coined the phrase impact investment?
There was a group of people, including me. There was Rockefeller folks. So the Rockefeller folks were the one who actually offered the center because they were actually having a lot of engagement with people like me. I was one of them, but I think they were engaging with Jacqueline in New York, Jacqueline Novogratz. I think Ronnie had already started Bridges Ventures by that time. Then there was other folks who were actually thinking about social stock exchange, London. There was a social stock exchange coming up in London as well. So people coming from very different. There were some people like Marie Lou, who was actually in microfinance. Triodos was there. She was also in that room. Margot Brandenburg, Anthony Buglevin, myself, Amit Bori. Amit was actually a consultant with Monitor. And most of us were meeting each other second or third time. So it's not that we were old friends. John Goldstein was there in that room. So many of us who now have evolved in very different ways. John is now with Goldman Sachs. So people have evolved in different directions. But we were there, and there was Monitor, which was actually providing a consulting, trying to help us actually unpack ourselves, the way we were thinking, helping us produce our ideas. And it was there this term impact investing came up. And Rockefeller actually said, oh, we like this term and we would like to back it with $1 million investment behind the name. And I was thinking, hey, if you put $1 million behind the name, the world will surely lap it up.
And the industry is now worth, north of $1 trillion a year. What do you make of the industry today? And the, I mean, because as you said, the language changes, impact investment is becoming mainstream. What do you make of the industry today in terms of how it's evolved?
The optimist entrepreneurial side of me believes that the tent of impact investing is now so wide that it is now as close to investing as is possible. Because before the term impact investing got coined, all investments delivered some kind of impact irrespective. Whatever you did created jobs, created livelihoods, created small and medium enterprises. So impact was being delivered by the enterprises irrespective by the investments. Some of us thought that we were doing things that normal investment or conventional investment was not willing to do. Now, the lines always blur. So when impact investing started becoming what you call mainstream, it started copying, becoming what the investing activity used to be. That means you generally go for the lowest hanging fruit, you go to the lowest risk area, and that's what has happened to impact investing as well as it has mainstreamed. Nothing wrong with it, because mainstream means that you would actually now look like what the mainstream world makes you want to, wants you to look like. Now, I always believed that impact investing started so that we can actually change the mainstream to us, not us to become the mainstream. So at this point of time, impact investing, which Global Impact Investor Network defines, as a, you have to be an impact investor, your onus is the following. You need to claim that you are an impact investor, you declare your intention. And then the second activity behind this is you then prepare a report and publish it that declares your impact. That means you measure what you have said. So we have brought down the idea of impact investing to these two critical areas. One is declaring your intentionality by adding impact to your name, and then actually presenting your results publicly. And a large number of people are able to do it. The general belief behind these two activities is once you have openly expressed your intention and you have published your report, the external pressure will make sure that you start working on delivering the good things.
You just sort of touched on that point. I mean, what were the sort of the big trends you're seeing in the industry today? How do you see the industry evolving?
So I think the industry is evolving towards two sides. One side is actually what you call the mainstream side. So the boundaries between what is impact investing and what is mainstream investing has blurred to significant extent in certain geographies. India is actually a very interesting example, simply because India was one place where if you do impact investing and you do it right, then you are actually the people who are building the path for these enterprises to engage with the mainstream world. For example, microfinance, it started with small amounts of capital, great struggle, etc. But today, India's microfinance industry is $50 billion. And there is no global fund, private equity major, which is not invested in India's microfinance. It has created or put multiple choices in the hands of a poor woman who had no choice just 10 years back. Now, that level of choices that we have created in India is beyond beyond people believe. And that to me is actually the great power of what you call mainstream, because it does not necessarily differentiate between different kinds of capital. And at the end of it, the customer, the receiver of capital and her or his efficiency becomes the defining feature. To me, when I started off, I wanted poor people to become rich. And my definition of being rich was, can we hand over multiple choices to poor people? At the end of it, if you have the right to make choices, you are rich. There is no end to greed. And I think in that sense, impact investing in whatever form it has operated has started delivering significant number of alternative choices to people coming from the low income or poor background.
What is the focus for your group now? Because obviously you operate in, I think, 53 countries now. I mean, is there an evolving focus of the mandate?
Yeah, so I think we were purist as we started. We were doing very small investments and very early stage startups in remote parts, etc., etc. I was very keen that what I was doing does not actually starts and ends with us. what has happened, and especially in India, where the transformation is that now there are angel networks in every remote part of India. There are startups. Prime Minister of India has taken startups to a stage where it is actually a complete rage. I mean, you have thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who want to become entrepreneurs. So job makers, not job seekers. So that transformation has happened. We have gone through this transition as one of the first and the pioneers. And we are trying to take our thought process to neighboring countries, so Indonesia, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Vietnam, and then to East Africa as well. We believe that there are a lot of things that have happened in India that has given us a blueprint that we can go and offer the governments of the smaller countries, the government places in Africa and others. So, and there are certain things we have learned that actually allows us to convince capital and entrepreneurs to take more risk in trying to create a more equal world, a world that sustainable development goals talk about, a world free of hunger, poverty, and inequity. So we are trying to not only be providers of capital in one form, which is just pure equity, only in early stage. We want to be a provider of capital at early stage, growth stage, late growth stage, as credit, as microfinance, as collateral-free loans, and also the builder of ecosystems around the world. We have done it reasonably successfully in India. We are trying to take it to every nook and corner of India. And then we are also taking it to East Africa, West Africa, North Africa, Bangladesh, Ghana, Indonesia, many other places. With the belief, can we create opportunities for those who are emerging from the bottom of the pyramid? That's why we defined our vision as bridging the opportunities gap for the emerging 3 billion. And the emerging 3 billion are the part of the 7 billion global population that does not constitute as absolute destitutes, but do not constitute as lower middle class also. So we are actually looking at the people who are between lower middle class and destitutes. And these are the people that we are trying to target, not just in India or in South Asia, but in Africa. And hopefully at some point of time, in Latin America as well. And maybe actually with the changing geography, with demographic profiles, with the challenges that Europe, Central Asia, even US and Northern America is facing, I think some of the skill sets that we have built can actually be of use in developed world as well.
You mentioned earlier in this point I wanted to come back to you about being very naive when you started and that being actually a strength rather than a weakness. What advice would you give people listening to this podcast who want to get into the impact investment industry, who want to make a difference, but just don't know where to start or feel that they don't have the requisite skills that they need to make the jump? What would you say to them?
But I think for those who want to be part of the impact investing space, you need to understand that you need to go through the pain for you to actually really add value. If you are looking for a job in impact investing, where you could be a bystander, which is what the job offers, you actually watch what is happening around you. You participate because you have skills, but you do not feel it inside you. But to feel it inside you, you might have to go through the challenges of what an entrepreneur goes through. So my general advice is, if you want to be in impact investing, first try to work with an entrepreneur who has tried to build a business that engages with the poor, so that you understand what the entrepreneur has gone through, what are the challenges on the ground. Then try to migrate or immigrate to impact investing, because then you will do better service to the industry that you stand for, rather than just be a bystander. Generally, to be an impact investor, empathy has to be very high. And unfortunately, a lot of people who just become impact investors, because they have never understood what it takes for an entrepreneur, ignore the most important ingredient in being an investor. It's not the skills, it's not the IRRs, it's not the Excel sheets. It is actually having the empathy to understand the challenge of the entrepreneur. So find that empathy in you. And if you find the empathy, then I'm sure you'll do very well.
And you mentioned, I mean, entrepreneurs and SMEs are still at the heart of what you do. When you look at sort of the big global pictures of trying to reach the SDGs and so forth, what is the role of entrepreneurs and smaller wealth creators and SMEs within that?
a lot of people actually in India are very confused between what is a startup and what is an SME. It's actually a raging debate. Nobody actually has clarity. But for simplifying the argument, a small and medium enterprise is the one which actually has a consistent performance, generally profitable, and is not necessarily looking for wild growth. While a startup is essentially challenging the status quo and is looking for an aggressive growth. These are the classical difference between an SME and a startup. SME is very critical and important simply because it's the largest job creator across the globe, developed or developing economies. Probably more important for the developed economies because developed economies are generally built on the basis of small and medium enterprises, not necessarily large enterprises, the world believes. For the developing economies, simply because you are going to follow the same path that the developed economy has followed, your SMEs become very critical because of the job creation, because they are the ones who actually build the entire capability and capacity of the future of the industry. Startups, on the other hand, are very critical if you want to move forward to a world that we have never noticed before. So one, we are finding or trying to solve for the challenges that are unheard of. I mean, how do you actually make the world without poverty, without equity, without hunger? This requires very different thinking than how a small and medium enterprise thinks. Small and medium enterprises are very critical and important, but a startup is one which actually is audacious and challenging the status quo and is solving a problem that has not been solved before. Therefore, it requires very different kind of capital, which is highly risk-taking, and therefore you require a very motivated individual to lead for it. So while SMEs are very critical and important and needs to be supported as the bulwark around which your development will happen as a country and nation, startup is the one that will break the back of the biggest challenges the humanity has ever faced. And so both, in my view, remain the most important areas for intervention for Avishkar Group, but not only for us, for anybody who backs and believes in sustainable development goals.
Thank you. And lastly, and we ask all our guests this question, and sort of just briefly, what are the three things that we're going to see in the impact investment industry this year?
If I reflect in the global tone, the way the world has changed, you might actually see impact investing find very strong resonance as an executor, that means as an investor in the developed economies of the world, not just the developing economies. Generally, the train of thought has been developed economy provided the capital and developing economy is where the crucible or the innovation crucible of impact investing had happened. But I think this year, with what we are seeing in Europe, the challenges, the wars, the global recession, many other challenges, you might see the gap between the rich and the poor expanding even in the developed economies. And the governments unable to step in. That's how the world, a developing economy is different from the developed economy. The second part of my thesis, which is actually a global challenge around the climate, where I see impact investing playing a significant role in seeding new ideas that are far more inclusive than what general climate solutions could be. Remember that all climate challenges first impact the poorest, and that has actually been the way it has always been, just that because poor do not go and knock at the doors of the government easily, it's easy to ignore them. Climate today is actually such a big news simply because it impacts the rich and the poor simultaneously. COVID taught us that anything can happen to anyone and that when things go out of hand and when nature reacts, retaliates, then it does not distinguish between rich and poor. And so I think in a post-COVID world, there is a heightened sensitivity around challenges linked to climate, especially the global fallouts of such challenges. And I also genuinely believe that there is a desire to have more inclusive solutions to challenges around climate. So natural resource-based biosequestration or any other solutions that are far more acceptable to the wider humanity. And some of these may actually create solutions for the poor while solving for the rich. So I think there would be a significant amount of innovations that will come through in this space as well.
Vineet, firstly, thank you for your time today. I think we could carry on talking for a lot longer, but thank you again for sharing your story with us and providing some really interesting insights. So thank you again on behalf of the Impact Equals podcast, and we'll let you get back to making lots more poor people rich. Thank you.